In the great hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman. Wonder Woman. Batman. Aquaman. And those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend, or I should say returning super friend, Paul Kien. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Rob. How you doing? Thanks for having me back.
I am doing great. You are the first returning guest of this show
honored.
That didn't do two in a row. You were on episode 11, I believe. I really should
that's
look
right.
these things up.
But yeah,
now you're back for episode issue 21. So again, thank you so much for coming back.
No, I'm very excited. You know, I love the series and really enjoy listening to the show. And so, and after all, this is where I got my podcast start. So I'll always have a soft spot for Mankind.
Your poor wife must be like, oh, great. Now he's podcasting. Oh, super. So, anyway, of course, you've been on the show. So we already went through your history with the series and the cartoons. So we can get right to the comic. As I said, this is Super Friends number 21. The story is Battle Against the Super Fiends by E. Nelson Birdwell, Ramona Fraiden, and Bob Smith. It was on sale March 22nd, 1979. Before we get to the plot, though, Paul, I got to ask you, what do you think of this cover? Which, of course, everybody you'll be able to see on our website, finewaterpodcast.com.
So it's a great cover, right? I think the green background and sky, you know, pops. It's got only of the Super Friends, only Superman and Wonder Woman, but it's got two of each of them, right? Mm-hmm. Superman's in the foreground, in the background, fighting himself, and Wonder Woman's fighting herself. You know, there is in the foreground Zan and Gina, and Zan's like, "That's it, you're Super Friends, you're beating your evil doubles." And then Gina's like, "The smart one, well, are they? Can we tell which one's which?" So, and I love it. If you think about Ramona Fraiden and the art, and I have several places in the issue that I point this out, but she's so good at facial expressions and the hair. Okay, look at Wonder Woman's hair, both Wonder Woman and Wondrous Woman, whichever one's which. The hair, you know, flying around is just, you know, really evocative of the motion. And so I really like that a lot.
I was going to say that even for Ramona Fraiden, this is a remarkably fluid cover.
Yeah.
And she was great at that. Now, part of that is her, and part of that is Bob Smith. He had a very lush ink line, which helped, you know, kind of accentuate the curves and the sort of movement that Ramona Fraiden would render. I mean, one of the covers you can see that, like, what a difference is. I think it was number 10 that was inked by Vince Coletta. And I'm not here to bash Vince Coletta. Everybody kind of does that, and it's easy to do. But like, Vince Coletta was not fluid. That was not something that his inks brought to any given pencil. But Bob Smith was great at that. And you can see what a difference, because that cover was penciled by Ramona Fraiden, and so was this one, but they look very different, and that's how much an inker can add. So to me, Bob Smith was really the best possible inker for her, because it's just, you see Superman and Superior Man punching the crap out of each other. His hair, the one guy's, Superman's hair is all mussed, and there's those motion lines, and then you got Wonder Woman tossing, again, maybe the other Wonder Woman down. I love the little body language of Jaina with her hand on her cheek.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it's like Margaret Dumont or something. Oh, Mr. Drysdale, you know, whatever. Oh, that's Beverly
Hills. Which is which?
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I mentioned that virtually every episode where Ramona Fraiden drew it, where I just love those little touches that she throws in. It's just extra work for her because she didn't have to draw that hand. She could have just drawn the head, but she bothered, and it just gives that kind of, oh, my Lord. I love it. And there's going to be about the whole story like that.
Yeah, if I only had one criticism of the cover, and I hope I don't mess something up for you, because once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Uh-oh.
Look at the Wonder Woman that's upside down. Her left leg is the bottom, you know, where her below her knee is. Just looks awkward to me. It doesn't look like it's bending exactly the right way. And you're the artist. You tell me whether you think it just looks like it's splayed out to the side more than would be natural. But that's
Yes, I see what you're saying. It doesn't. It the cover is not ruined for me or anything. But,
no.
But I do see what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, you sit here and you're looking at these 40-year-old comics, and you spend an hour, you know, preparing, reading through this and all the rest. You kind of pick up stuff like that.
Ramona's like, there's no way some nerd is going to be looking at this 40 years from now. And I'm saying, it's fine. It's good. I mean, that was something that we learned in art school, was like, you always know how well your figure work is. If when you draw a figure in anything other than standing straight up,
right,
look at it. If you turn the page and you look at how weird does it look? And man, I learned that the hard way so many times, where you would draw somebody upside down and you would draw it. You would draw it right side up, because it was easier. But then you look at it and you go, oh, this looks weird. And that's just, you know, that was separating, you know, sort of the proverbial men from the boys. In this case, the woman from the from the boys, because Ramona Freyd knew how to do this stuff.
So, but yeah. Bottom line, this cover does its job, right? I mean, who wouldn't want this book, right? Who wouldn't want this comic? It's great.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I am, like I've said on other episodes, like things I'm a sucker for. One of the things I'm a sucker for is like the evil duplicates. That's always a fun, you know, just watching them, you know, and then there's a lot of them. So let's get right to it. So the plot is such, it starts with the Super Friends spying a spaceship landing on Earth, one that looks just like the kind of ships that came from the Wonder Twins' home planet, Exor. The first person to emerge is Illic, the jester who the Wonder Twins used to work alongside with. Also inside is the High Counselor, Ulpar. It's tough to say all these names, who tells the Wonder Twins that Exor is in trouble. Two fellow carnival members and shapeshifters named Yeltu and Fegla tracked this is like a Scrabble word score thing here. Tracked the Wonder Twins back to Earth and studied the planet, specifically its superpowered inhabitants. Since Yeltu and Fegla can duplicate humans, they transformed into Superman and Wonder Woman. Using their superior powers, the two have been going on a criminal rampage across Exor. The Wonder Twins want to help, but are worried that if they return to their home planet, they will be handed back to the carnival they escaped from. Ulpar. God, I'm sorry, everybody. Ulpar promises.
You just want to say Ultra the Multi.
I think I do. Well, that's true. Ulpar promises their safety, and then the Super Friends step in and vow to go to Exor as well. Superman and Wonder Woman chase down their evil duplicates, with the now christened Superior Man hiding a piece of kryptonite as a sucker punch. But Wonder Woman uses her lasso to wrest it from his hands, and in short order, the baddies are defeated. But when they are about to be brought into custody, they transform again, this time into Aquaman and Hawkgirl. Aquaman and the Wonder Twins give chase. The Wonder Twins defeat the foe Aquaman, and the real Aquaman commands a school of flying fish to pluck the foe Hawkgirl's wings, making her fall into the ocean. Yalta and Fegla are brought in once more, and once again, they try the old switcheroo, this time turning into Batman and Batgirl. This time, there, the Super Friends don't trade villains, and Batman takes on Cape Man, and Robin defeats Cape Woman. The Wonder Twins mention that Yeltu and Fegla's one weakness was every time they shapeshift, their strength is drained. So now that they have tried three times and lost, they are temporarily sapped of their shape-changing abilities. Ulpar arrives to tell Wonder Twins, as a way to thank them for their help, their status as fugitives has been resolved, and they are free to go back to Earth if they wish. Illic has some good news, too. He was the proper owner of Gleek, but he now sees that the little guy is happier with Xanajana and tells him that Gleek is theirs. Gleek expresses joy over that decision. All right. So, Paul, what overall, I mean, we're going to go through it, of course, bit by bit. But overall, what did you think of this issue?
So, of course, it's a lot of fun. It's and like you said, it's I think everybody's a sucker for the evil duplicates. But, you know, I really like a lot the first half of the story. The second half, I felt got a little bit simplistic with the formula, and the end was a little rushed for me. But, you know, these 17 page stories, that happens a lot, right?
Yeah.
But overall, you know, obviously it's a lot of fun. Really, really do enjoy it.
Yeah, I can send it. The evil duplicate thing is always funny. And I love the fact, and we'll get into the whys of this, that there's sort of cameos by other superheroes in the DC universe. And that's partly because that the two fugitives, the Yeltu and Fegula, they were watching all of this, you know, sort of closed circuit cameras or however the hell they'd managed to do it. Yeah. And they saw all the different super friends. So it's like basically whoever they can see, they can duplicate, which is why they duplicate into Batgirl and Hawkgirl. And again, every issue of Super Friends, I love the core concept. I love these five characters. But anytime I get to see Ramona Freyden drawing any members of the Justice League, yes, I am here for it.
Yes.
I just love it.
Absolutely. No, she does a great job. And you know, I find that interesting on that scene you're talking about where the two fugitives are watching the closed caption TV. I got to think that the one at the bottom where it's Batgirl and Robin came straight out of an issue of Batman Family that Enos and Breadwell wrote himself, right?
Your beloved Batman Family, yes. Yeah, right. It's kind of funny when you think about like how far they could have taken it, because you're like, yeah, what happens if these two guys had seen, you know, again, Ultra the Multi-Alien or something? Or whatever. Right. Hey, yeah, we're going to turn into Brother Power the Geek. Like, all right, what's his power? Again, there's this opening sequence where Altar comes out and he looks a little like a bald Spock, basically. And he's got his sort of costume on, and you've got Illich, the carnival guy. Now, I will say, like, the initial bit where they talk about these guards that were watching the Wonder Twins escape, like chasing them.
Yeah.
And then we see
a little creepy.
Like, yeah, a little bit. But then we see like they get the imposters come in and they're like, they have kept us prisoner. And we realize that they're fake. And like, as I was reading this flashback, there was a couple moments where I was like, wait, what's going on? And then I felt stupid that I was confused by a comic book meant for children in 1979. I was like, I should be smarter than this, but I will say for a moment, it's like, wait, who's who here in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I liked a couple of things, right? Obviously, Illich, we've seen before, yep, in the backup story in number 14, and he's got wearing the same outfit. I don't think he's got a different set of clothes. And but what I really thought was the interesting sort of almost underlying thing of the whole thing is Yeltu and Fegla are almost like evil versions of Xan and Jaina, right? They're older. They're like kind of like, what would they have been like if they had never escaped from the circus and grew up more resentful, right? And, you know, like look at page 3, you know, when they first turn into Superior Man.
Oh, the faces are so good.
And Wondrous Woman, the faces are sort of like quite sinister, you know, yep, for a kid's book like that. So anyway, I just think I like page 3 a lot with the like I said, the cameo, the Batman family. They get these sort of sinister looking Superman and Wondrous Woman, I guess. pretty cool concept, if you ask me.
Yeah, like I said, I love Superman with the pointed ears.
Yeah.
It's weird that they can transform, but they can't get rid of the pointed ears. Like, yeah, you would think if you could transform into Superman, you could just morph your ears to not give away that you're not Superman.
You would think. I mean, none of their costumes are exactly perfect, you know, so it's a little odd. Like, you know, later on we'll see Aquaman's belt isn't quite right. So,
oh man, I got something about that too. Yeah. there's a little bit of nice bit of characterization where the Wonder Twins are unsure about helping their home planet because they don't want to be basically imprisoned again. And then, yeah, the Super Friends step in and say, we're going to help. And you even have Altar say, why? Exor is not your world. And Wonder Woman says, true, but we fight evil wherever it's found.
Yeah.
Superman says, besides, we don't like the idea of criminals stealing our powers. And that kind of shames the Wonder Twins into, yeah, going along, which is, again, a nice little detail.
That was really a nice touch. I'm glad you brought it up. I was going to, too, if you didn't. Because, you know, it's like Xan and Jaina, the whole point of them being there in the first place is for them to learn what it's like to be a superhero, right? And so this is a lesson. This is what the Justice League does, right? They step in and help where they can. So I thought that was terrific.
Yeah, a good little lesson to teach kids. You know, yeah, it's like, okay, you gotta do the right thing, even if it risks your personal safety, maybe, or your personal comfort at the very least. I mean, obviously, you know, Xan and Jaina are dealing with some extraordinary circumstances, being fugitives on a planet. That's not anything anybody's gonna have to deal with. But nevertheless, that's a nice. I love that Xan goes, I feel ashamed. I hesitated to go to the aid of my home world, yet the Super Friends, to whom is only another distant planet, are willing to go. thank you, Xan. So then they get to Exor. Superman, of course, tugs them all in this little bubble that he brings along with them. And yeah, it does get into the formula a bit where Superman and Wonder Woman are like, well, we're going to take on the two fugitives because they have our powers. And it's like, well, why not everybody? Why you traveled all the way to Exor just for Batman, Robin, and Aquaman to sit on the beach and just stare or something? Like, it's like a little like, what?
Yeah, and that's kind of my sort of issue. Like, most of the times when they split up into teams, and I get the reason to do that. Everybody gets a moment of glory, right? When they split up in teams, it's because there's multiple threats, right?
Yeah.
And they have to go to different places, and they split up into the teams and go do their thing. This one where it's sequential, it just kind of doesn't work for me in that regard, you know?
You just need to cut back to the three heroes just sitting there like,
yeah. And you got to say, Robin on this page 6, is a bit of a dunce, right? And then Wonder Woman is not real nice to him. She goes,
I wrote that down. She kind of snaps at him. Why don't you tell everybody what that exchange is?
They come to the planet Exor, and they said, oh, we just saw the evil ones have started looting the aluminum exchange. Robin's like, I don't get it. Aluminum is such a common metal. And Jaina says, well, on Earth, yes, but it's rare on Exor. Here's regarded as a precious metal. And Wonder Woman says, well, when you're done a bit more space hopping, Robin, you'll realize how very different things on other planets are. I'm like, zing, zing on Robin. I'm like, I just thought that was pretty funny. And I was just like laughing. I was like, you know, some Bridwell usually has him get his comeuppance in some of the other stories too, but I thought that was funny.
He's going to have to go to Paradise Island to take care of that burn that she just dropped on him. Yeah. I mean, my God. I'm like, if I was Robin, I'd be like, I've been on a lot of planets, Wonder Woman. I may be just Robin the Boy Wonder, but I've been to a lot of planets. And come on. So then Superman and Wonder Woman go, and they head off Superior Man and Wondrous Woman. Again, with the great faces on page 7,
yeah,
where the evil Superman has
I love it,
giant rock of kryptonite. And I mean, that face is just marvelous. He's like, yeah, like he's so excited that he's going to drop this whammy on Superman.
I love it.
And I love that when Superman and Wonder Woman arrive, the Superior Man is holding this giant boulder behind his arms. Like, he's like, no, you're not going to. I've totally looked.
It's glowing.
And it's glowing, too. He's like, I totally don't look suspicious here. It's like, he is Superman. I mean, they knew about this coming.
And then at the bottom of that page, it's like, by the seven seas, is the woman is attacking me?
Yes. We're very like, sexist here on Exor. I like that. I like Demon of Foltis. He's got to work on that. It's no Greg Rao or anything like that.
No.
So Wonder Woman, there's a great action sequence here by Frayden where Wonder Woman lassos him with her lasso, and then he starts flying, and he says, I can still fly. I'll pull the loop away from you. And she says, not if I hang on long enough to order you to stop. And just by the command, because she does lasso him, that freezes him in midair, and you see like kind of like the palsy lines kind of like he's frozen. I thought that's a fun idea that even in the middle of somebody flying, it's still going to work. Yeah. So I love that she freezes him in midair. I think that's really cool.
Well, this is my favorite page of the issue. Cause she does that. And then she rolls him up in the lasso, and he turns back into the Exorian, and you know, look at her hair and her body motions throughout the whole page. So this is my favorite page. We'll come back to that later too. But this is really a well done part.
Yeah, it's really well paced, and again, I love Diana's hair flowing in all different directions. Again, like we talked about, Frayden just wonderful at motion. So then we get Superman versus the sort of evil Wonder Woman. She throws her lasso around him, and of course, it's not really a magic lasso, but she thinks it'll work. And he just
goes, "Are you kidding?
Are you kidding?" And he just bursts it with his chest, which is great. And then he uses his heat vision to fuse her magic bracelets together, which renders her basically immobile. And then even says, like losing your powers when a man welds your bracelets together, which is, I don't know if that's still in Wonder Woman lore. Yeah. It was for a very long time. It does seem kind of a peculiar touch. I know George Perez had it in his run of Wonder Woman.
Yeah, at some point they got rid of that. I don't remember exactly when because it's a bit much. But my thought of this, I just went, wait a minute, because if she's got the weakness of Wonder Woman, why doesn't Superior Man have the weakness of Kryptonite? You know?
Right, yeah.
So I'm like, there's a bit of a leap in logic there, because I went, huh? And then I had to go back and reread it to make sure I read it right. And I was like, well, that does, you know, that's the kind of thing, even when I was a kid, would take me out of the story, you know? It's kind of nerdy like that. What can I say?
Well, yeah. So we're all here. This is a safe space.
I was going to say.
So then they round them up and they transform again into Aquaman. Here he calls himself Waterman. Fegla turns into Hawk Girl. She calls herself Bird Woman. Now you can tell which is the evil Aquaman because the evil Aquaman's belt is wrong. He's got the A, but the little points, the bottom points of the A don't stick down past the belt. But curious, if you look at how high that A is, yeah. I mean, that would stab Aquaman in the stomach if he tried to bend his gut in any way. I mean, that is right up into his rib cage. That looks very painful.
I agree 100%. I mean, I've always had a problem when that A was drawn terribly big in the first place, because either side of your belt area there, it's gonna hurt with any of those point spots for sure.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I do think it's funny they just get the costumes just a little bit wrong.
Yeah, they don't have attention to detail here. So then we get these panels with, you know, ostensibly Hawk Girl, which is great because Hawk Girl is one of my favorite DC characters. I love Hawkman and Hawk Girl together, but I even love Hawk Girl more than I even love Hawkman. And so of all the characters to work into it, maybe Ian B just had a favorite or something that he wanted, because I mean, she could have transformed into any character in the DC universe. But I just love that we get a sort of Hawk Girl appearance in this comic drawn by Ramona Freyden again, which is like my favorite thing.
Yeah, no, she does a great costume. You know, great the headpiece that Hawk Girl wears. I really do think it's really, you know, really a well done. I do have an issue that I think it is funny that the Waterman doesn't have enough strength to break out of the ice straitjacket. I was like, that's Jaina's powers I can see being pretty useful, but they always are really stretching for Zan, I think.
Right. Yeah. So I love the moment where when Hawk Girl and Aquaman, the evil versions, fly off, and Superman goes, "I'll catch them." And Aquaman says, "No, Superman, I want a crack at that counterfeit copy of me." So we're going to leave the Man of Steel behind again to just stare off into the middle distance there while he's on the beach, just like, all right, okay.
Museums here on X-Ford that we can check out?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess, I don't know. Is there a space museum I can visit? Maybe I can go visit the Legion, go back in time, go visit the Legion of Superheroes or something, or go forward in time, go visit the Legion and come back or something. But then we get this extended sequence with Hawkman and, Hawk Girl and Aquaman. And this is, I mean, I know that I'm prejudiced about this. This is my favorite sequence. First of all, because it's the longest of all the chapters, kind of the take. It's Aquaman gets the most to do, even because you got the fake Aquaman and then the real Aquaman. Yeah. But there is this marvelous panel, page 13, the bottom right panel, of Aquaman with his head out of the water as he is staring up at Hawk, the evil Hawk Girl, and that is just one of the most best designed panels I've ever seen.
I mean, you're like looking at it from under the water.
Yes,
it's
yes.
really
it's very Steven Spielberg Jaws. You know, you're under the water line, and I love that the colorist. You know, I mean, this is what you would do, but it still is a nice touch that Aquaman's colors under the water are muted because you're looking at through the water. I just think that is. There's so many ways to draw that. That would be pretty standard, but Freyden. I mean, drawing people's faces from that angle really hard.
Yeah,
like really hard. It looks just great. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. And I like how he commands the flying fish, the alien flying fish, I guess they are. It's pretty cool, too.
I love it. And I love the way she draws, Ramona Freyden draws the flying fish. It's like the piranhas or something. It's great. And I just think that's a boss move to just shoot the flying fish into the air to just clip her wings. Yep. I'm like, that's a great little detail. And then she falls into the water. She retransforms and Aquaman rescues her.
Okay. And there is a typical Enos and Bridwell point right down here, because he's like, well, knowing that, you know, in the comics, right, they have their nth metal belts and they have their wings that help guide them through the air. And knowing that, well, she's got the wings, but she doesn't have the belt. So that's why she fell out of the ground. I'm like, that's another one. Like, well, if she duplicated the wings.
Right. Right. Yeah. But not the nth metal. Yeah. What?
So maybe she just didn't know about it, I suppose, when she just was watching that TV screen. But I do think it's funny that he had to come up with a reason why she would fall into the water because of that. Right. You know, because knowing that all those readers would say, wait a minute, what about the nth metal belt?
Yeah. That I'm sure that bothered E. Nelson. Just that, you know, that would bother him if he had made a mistake like that. He would lay at night and go, oh, I should have mentioned the nth metal. So then they round him up again, and then they turn into Batman and Batgirl here, called Cape Man and Cape Woman. Not the most imaginative names in the world. And then I love they're like, we know from the other fights that Batman will not attack me, but you. So I must prepare to battle Robin. Wrong again, Cape Man. This time we aren't switching opponents. I just kind of like that he just like tells them their plan. And so then Robin defeats Batgirl. Now, of course, we really can't have it wouldn't be proper in a kid's comic to have a man punching a woman, even an evil woman. So Robin has to come up with another way of subduing her. And he talks about that he has laughing gas, something he picked up from the Joker. Which
loved it.
Seems a little, I don't know. Like, do we want to be replicating what he does in any way? But okay,
good fine. Role model there, Robin.
Yeah, I mean, come on. But anyway, she's overcome with laughter as he ties her down. And there's, again, you know, I know this is like, this is not a nitpick because I don't have a problem with it. I love it, but it's such a granular detail. In the final panel of this page, page 16,
yeah,
where while during all this, Batman is pasting Cape Man.
Yeah.
All around. And you see Robin say, need any help, Batman? And Batman, as he's punching Cape Man, goes, I'm doing fine, pal. And the way it was lettered, it's not I'm doing fine, pal, exclamation mark, as if Batman is exerting himself in any way. It's a sentence. I'm doing fine, pal. He's just saying it like you would say any other normal sentence. I love that the idea that Batman is not exerting himself in any way punching this guy. He's just saying it like, I'm doing fine, pal. You know, no effort on Batman's part is being made here.
I think that's really funny. Yeah.
So when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's really funny. So then the wrap up as usual with Super Friends, it all basically takes place in one page. E. Nelson Brovo like to kind of do that. I am a little perturbed at the Wonder Twins where they explain, let me think. First, they talk about the villains, and this is first they copied the most powerful Superman and Wonder Woman. Then the less powerful Aquaman and Hawkgirl. Hey, now step off, Jane. And now come on.
I know. I was like, I was reading because Robin asked them, hey, have you deduced why they took those forms? And she says, well, it's obvious because of all that. And I was like, really? Is that really deduction? I don't know if that would get them through detective school.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, it's a little like, oh, okay, all right. And then we find out this thing about their powers, like, okay. And then we find out that the Wonder Twins learn that they are no longer considered fugitives, and then Illick hands over Gleek to them. Illick looks like it's a nice touch. I like that, you know, the Gleek is like, he's clearly, you know, he's attached to you too. Illick really does look like somebody that would be dressed at like a mattress opening store. You know what I mean? Like, he looks like that kind of get a king of a sleep with the, you know, he's like, he doesn't like, spinning, I know that. Sign. Yeah. I mean, I know that he's a carnival clown,
right.
So he's in that costume, but it's like, he looks so different than the way like Altar looks, you know, I mean, like, because he dresses kind of like a superhero, but Illick has, of course, that he looks like W.C. Fields.
Yeah. I think he was based on somebody like that.
Yeah, probably. So then it gets a nice moment where Gleek expresses his joy, and that's the end of the issue. That is it's a one and done. So overall, it's a really fun story. Now, there's one thing I wanted to mention about the letters page. Do you have the letters pages, or are you reading this digital?
I was actually looking at it on my iPad, so I don't have it with me. But go ahead. Go for it.
The one thing I thought was very charming in the letters page, where they're talking about printing letters from issue 16, where the Super Friends fought those aliens that were, could, you know, do like interdimensionality, where they could go in any angle, and it was like an M.C. Escher thing. And specifically, one of the letters from a guy named Roy says that, noting the design of the aliens, he says that Ramona Fraiden must have done some homework on Hieronymus Bosch before she went to work. And then Enid Blyton says, well, no, she actually looked up the work of M.C. Escher, which of course is the kind of designs that she was sort of copying for those aliens. But I just thought it was charming that for a comic book aimed at 8 or 9 year olds, there's a mention of Hieronymus Bosch and M.C. Escher.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you hear something funny, I also was looked at the Super Friends Saturday Morning Comics, the art covers that came out in the last couple of years. Mm. And Ramona Fraiden wrote the introduction. And in that, she actually references that, Rob. She goes, and I'm reading right from it. As I recall, my mind boggling when I tried to envision and draw the Escher-like world without left or right or up or down as the script called for it. I remember having fun with the airy spaghetti-like space creatures who lived in that world and never had to deal with the drag of gravity. They reminded me of maybe Nelson, too, of the airy creatures who lived on Earth's surface in H.G. Wells' The Time Machine and never had to deal with the drag of having to work.
That's marvelous. That's great. Yeah. That's amazing. She still remembered that.
Yeah. She's pretty sharp.
Yeah, it's wonderful. She's great. When I was a kid, I mean, I probably would have, I mean, I don't know how I would have looked this up, but when I was a kid, when you're a little kid, you want to be older. You want to be an adult. And so you like to find out what these references are.
Yeah.
And I just love that Nelson Bridwell just so casually drops it in there. He doesn't say that, you know, the painter M.C. Escher. He's just going to okay. And maybe if you're a little kid, you're going to look it up. Probably
look
not.
It up. Yeah.
But you might. And just the idea of Hieronymus Bosch being mentioned in a kid's comic to me is just very, very charming. I love all that. So that's great. I think it's just a great, great little letter to throw those references in. So overall, it's a really fun story. Evil Duplicates. Again, love the Evil Duplicates. An appearance great by art. Batgirl, by Hawkgirl. I mean, again, I just love all that stuff.
Yep. Great art and throughout. Really looks good.
Absolutely. So who would you rate as the best friend in this particular?
So I think I know who you're going to vote for. You've sort of given it away.
Am I that transparent, Paul?
Yeah, a little bit. But and I almost gave it to Aquaman as well. But I just had to give it to Wonder Woman for that sequence on page 8 where she captures Superior Man. I just thought that, you know, that was clever how she did it. It was executed really well by Ramona Fraiden, and you know, just looks fabulous on the page. And like I said, that's my favorite page of the issue. So that's my vote.
I agree. I said I did go with Aquaman just because I think the clever use of using the flying fish to subdue Hawkgirl is really cool. And he said he gets more pages than anybody else in the in the sequence. But yeah, both those two sequences are great.
Yeah, that was a close second to me. Close second to me.
They're both really, really well done. So as for the villain roundup, would these two villains, you know, maybe have some traction outside the DC universe, outside the Super Friends universe? I think so.
I think so, too. Like I said, evil versions of Xan and Jaina. You could see that.
Yeah, that you could really do something with that. And having the ability to duplicate anybody they see, that'd be really cool. Get them to Earth, and all of a sudden they're becoming, you know, Zatanna and Dr. Fate. You know, that'd be really, I mean, I know they can't quite match the powers, but they can get kind of close. Yep. So, yeah, I actually think these two, they have a kind of General Zod and Ursa sort of read on them. So I don't think we ever see them again. But, I actually think these two could have gone somewhere outside the DCU if outside the Super Friends universe, if E. Nelson Bridwell had ever thought to either use them in some of his stories or some other writer. But I thought these two had some potential.
I agree. Maybe if Mark Russell writes a sequel to that Xan and Jaina Wonder Twins comic he did.
That would be a great idea. So overall, like I said, it's a really solid issue. I enjoyed it very, very much. Again, I love the two-parters, but I also love the one and dones just because, they were a little rushed here and there, but again, it's comics were only 17 pages back then. I mean, what can you, what can you do?
I did discover something interesting about the 17 page thing before you wrap up, just as if people are, want to read, cause this is essentially a sequel to that backup story where Xan and Jaina were, given the origin of the one double-sized, you know, or extra-sized Super Friends issue that there is sort of in between the DC implosion there. And what's really interesting, I went to reread that because so I could remind myself, and it's not on DC Universe. The issue 14 where the Wonder Twins origin just has the 17-page story, doesn't have the 8-page.
Oh, that's a shame.
That was I think it's just an oversight. Like, why would they? Because it's in this. Because then I went and I got my hardcover book. I'm, you know, got to double up here. I got the issue and I got the hardcover book, and it's in there. And so it just it's a weird omission, I think, from DC Universe. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because it's a really charming story. So, yes, and it's a really really fun issue. So before we wrap up here, this is the Sunday show. So we have to thank our sponsor for this episode. We normally do it at the front of the show. Here we're doing it at the back. And on this episode of For All Mankind is sponsored by InStock Trades. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. So, Paul, what did you bring from InStockTrades.com?
So, I brought, the Justice League of America, the Bronze Age Omnibus, Volume 3, okay? Why did I pick this? This is a monster. Let me read the solicit on InStock Trades here. It says, the JLA moves to the second half of the 70s with tales guest starring the Justice Society, the Legion of Superheroes, and heroes from the long-gone past, including Jonah Hex, Viking Prince, Enemy Ace, and more. Plus, the league's mascot, Snapper Carr, your favorite, Rob, turns against the team. The Phantom Stranger helps the team battle a returning pantheon of ancient gods. The Martian Manhunter faces Despero for the lives of the League. And the Secret Society of Supervillains swap bodies with the world's greatest superheroes, which never had a sequel written to it. Plus, Black Lightning is invited to join the JLA, but turns down the invitation for mysterious reasons. I mean, these are classics. Collects Justice League 147 to 182, Super Team Family 11 to 14. That's the hunt for Gene Loring, right? DC Special 27, DC Special Series 6. Secret Society of Supervillains 15, DC Comics Presents 17, where Superman meets Firestorm, right?
Wow.
And the best part of this book, because I actually got this book a couple of weeks ago, and it pages from The Amazing World of DC Comics number 14, which was, I read that book, that magazine to shreds when I had it as a kid, because it had all the details, had summaries of all the past adventures of the Justice League in it. So this has a lot of great extra features in it. It is regular price. It's first, let me just say, it's 1,192 pages, full color hardcover. So it's a massive book. I can barely.
That's insane.
Regular price, $125. In stock trades price, $72.50, saving 42%. And it's a bargain at $72.50, let me tell you.
I 1,200 pages of Justice League. I can't.
And most of it's Lord. Jerry Conway. I know it's a little before your very favorite part of the league history.
Right. This is all great stuff.
But this is probably my favorite part, you know, because it's, I mean, just listen to all those stories I was just talking about. So this is really great stuff.
And on the cover by Carl Kruschel.
And on the cover.
Who's the center Hawkgirl. Figure? Yeah, exactly. Hawkgirl. Yep. Holding a mace. Exactly. Yeah, holding a mace. Love that mace. So yeah, it's a great pick. I have never actually... I guess I must have seen some of these books in a comic store here and there, but man, if I saw this one, I'm not going to buy it in a comic store because I don't have $125 to drop, but I would want to lift it just for the heft of it, just to feel it in my
hand. The other good part about it, these are contemporaneous stories to the ones we're reading right now, mm-hmm. in Super Friends. You know, this is the same era, the same, you know, late 70s time frame that the Super Friends stories were occurring in. So this is the JLA that, you know, some Bridwell is referring to.
That's right. It's a great pick. So my pick from InStockTrades.com, because this is a Wonder Twins kind of centric issue, is the aforementioned Wonder Twins miniseries by Mark Russell. You just mentioned it earlier. This is Wonder Twins Volume 2, The Fall and Rise of the Wonder Twins. Anybody reprinting Wonder Twins numbers 7 through 12, anybody who's read the series knows it's really, really fantastic. Again, written by Mark Russell, who was a guest on the show, drawn by Stephen Byrne. And it's got all the fun of the Wonder Twins, but with a lot of great social commentary. Mm-hmm. Thrown in. It's just a really great series, and I'm hoping maybe DC will do a second, like you mentioned, Paul, a sequel or an ongoing series, because it's just a lot of fun with you know, again, with some stuff to say, and just a real blast. So Wonder Twins is in Volume 2. The normal price is $16.99, but in-stock trades price is only $9.85. You save 42% off. So for these and all the other trade paperback needs, visit InStockTrades.com, and we thank them for sponsoring this episode of For All Mankind. So that is going to do it for the issue review. Paul, thank you so much for coming back. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Rob. It's a blast. Anytime.
All right. Great. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Yeah, mainly just hit me up on Facebook, Paul Kien, K-I-E-N, and I had a couple people the last few times I've been on the shows just sort of friend me and, you know, get to post things and hear, you know, see things on there. But I appreciate that and always fun to meet new people.
Absolutely. So, all right, everybody, thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned. We're going to play some commercial announcements. When I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
A World on Fire,
an All-Star Squadron podcast.
Join your hosts, Billy D.
and Herman, as we take a deep dive into the seminal DC Comics series created by Roy Thomas and Rich Buckler.
We'll be covering the series issue by issue, spotlighting our favorite characters,
and talking about the historical tie-ins as well.
So join us every month in A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast.
Coming in December 2020 to a podcatcher near you.
Sends him over 100 feet at top speed. Loop-de-loop, and he's not through yet. Into the dragster. Evil super sprint car with built-in drag chute to slow him down. What a hope. And now, the Sky Cycle. That daredevil death-defying supersonic sky plane on wheels. And here he is on the super cool chopper bike. With the power that can really rip. He's sensational. He's Evil Knievel. He's a knockout. He's ideal.
And now we're back with listener feedback, and this is the feedback for the previous episode of For All Mankind, where we covered issue number 20 with my pal Martin Gray. We're going to get right to the comments from the website, FrienWaterPodcast.com. First up is NetMinistrator, who says, Denny O'Neill's legendary contempt for Aquaman showed in that dejected panel you mentioned. I believe in your old JLA satellite blog, there was a mention that Denny pretty much exiled the King of the Seven Seas from his JLA run in the 60s until the 80s, except for that weird Never Was tale. When he indicated that Aquaman was hard to write for, other writer stories of him just proved that there are no bad characters, just bad writing of them. I think I remembered the legend was that Denny O'Neill didn't so much dislike Aquaman, is that he just simply forgot that Aquaman was a member. Like, it was that level. It was that sort of innocent ignorance. He just forgot that Aquaman was part of the book, and so he didn't write the character in there. And obviously he did appear in the Never Was story, so maybe that tale's a more apocryphal, but I didn't take it that Denny doesn't like Aquaman. I think he just had a view of the character that, as a mega fan like myself, I don't agree with. Jason Keen says, I'm sure it's been brought up before, but why aren't Zan and Jaina sidekicks for Aquaman? Zan constantly powers him up while Jaina gets to show off alien sea creatures. It's an interesting idea, Jason. Love the show, and thanks for the great trade suggestions. Well, you're very much welcome. Edobosnar says, okay, I don't love how Aquaman is treated in this issue, but the panel of him sitting on the rock and lamenting the sudden loss of his mighty strength is adorable. And Revenge of the Leafy Monsters is such an awesome title. It's worthy of an entire story arc in Swamp Thing. Alan Moore's Revenge of the Leafy Monsters. Brian Linton says, I'm right there with you, Edo. I don't like seeing Aquaman beat himself up over his failure, but there's just something about that panel of him sitting on the rock that I love. I think part of it is the great body language by Kurt Schaffenberger. It's cartoony, but it just has enough kind of realism to it that it is very charming. Dr. Rand says, another great episode. Always great to hear Martin, such a wise guest. No Aquaman on the cover. This time he got Shaf-ted. I would give this crazy story a pass, Rob. It makes as much sense as any of the cartoon stories. Merlin walking through the forest? Sure. Ray that puts cheetah heads and bizarro heads on people? Sure. Anyways, odd little story, but lessons learned. And Zan in the ice mirror is classic. Little Russell Bourbon says, a great show with a special guest, Martin. Very entertaining and fun. This must have been a difficult conversation to schedule, though, with what the different parallel time zones, planet Greenwich, mean time meets planet Eastern Standard. What a crisis. Who wore the yellow gloves? This is my least favorite issue of Super Friends. I don't think I knew that Sergius was really Dan O'Neill at this time. I think Ian B. outed him in the letters page a few issues later, if I recall correctly. Anyway, I eventually learned who he was, and that's when I realized, well, of course Aquaman gets nothing to do in the story. Denny hates Aquaman. I've since learned that this is not actually true, but you couldn't tell that to teenage me. And full disclosure, Denny also wrote what is probably the most favorite issue of Super Friends. So to answer Rob's hypothetical question, yes, he does get better. This one, though, for all the reasons Rob pointed out, just doesn't work. I always loved Kurt Schaffenberger's art. To this day, I remember the first issue of Shazam I happened across. It had a fantastic Marvel family story in it with art by Kurt. Loved his stuff from that day on. Cellar Dweller says, many thanks to Rob and Martin for their work on this podcast. Count me in as one of the people who were not impressed with this issue. It was just too weird for me, which I guess is an odd comment to make when discussing a comic book with superheroes. It's not like they are grounded in reality. Regarding the camera stopping Superman at that time, one of Superman's weaknesses was magic, so having the camera shoot magic energy at him was enough to stop him. I'm not sure if this weakness exists in current continuity. Like Rob, I was annoyed at the way Aquaman was portrayed again on his own solo mission. In past issues, Aquaman mentioned that living underwater built up his muscles, making him stronger. Now he's not stronger than an average man. Regarding the cover and what the Wonder Twins say, in a future letter column that has feedback for issue number 20, someone wrote in to say, Aquaman and Robin may not be our favorites, but they do help. As for Zan giving the director a raspberry from the mirror, Zan and Jaina are still teens in the book, so it could fit into his personality to do that. Regarding the letter about the diversity heroes and the Black Vulcan, Black Lightning thing, this has been discussed online, specifically by Tony Isabella, creator of Black Lightning. According to Tony, Hanna-Barbera wanted to use Black Lightning for Super Friends. What should have happened was that Hanna-Barbera would have paid DC Comics, who would have then give a cut to Tony Isabella as the creator-owner of the character. However, DC didn't want to do that. They wanted HB to pay them, and then on top of that, pay extra to Tony Isabella. Tony says specifically in his interview that his cut should have come from DC Comics' take. Hanna-Barbera didn't want to pay extra, so they created Black Vulcan, and DC Comics let them get away with it. Tony went on to say in his last issue of Black Lightning, he took a slap at Hanna-Barbera. A story was done called The Other Black Lightning, where a villainess hired a guy to have him be passed as the real Black Lightning. Her name was Barbara Hanna. You can find these comments under 2 minutes long on YouTube. That is marvelous, Cellar Dweller. I haven't read that issue of Black Lightning. Now I want to read it. That sounds really fun. Tony is a friend, and I got to hear stories from him in person about some of the travails of working on Black Lightning and all that stuff with Hanna-Barbera, but I didn't know that he took a shot at them in the comic. That's marvelous. I really got to check that out. Chris Franklin from our network, of course, says, great discussion, gents. I haven't read this issue, but just based on the synopsis, I couldn't help but think of the curmudgeonly C.C. Beck and the vitriol he spewed over Denny's scripts for the revived Shazam title. As much as I love Denny's work, I don't think his heart was ever into whimsical tales. It's hard to imagine how comic book writers of the past were essentially jobbers, wrote whatever story the company needed writing. If Denny had a contract with so many pages he was asked to write per month, if there wasn't a Batman assignment or what have you, he may pick up a Super Friends or a War Tale, etc. Most of these writers were able to shift from genre to genre, but I don't think Denny ever quite felt comfortable in the kiddie space, and it shows. At least he didn't drop the Wonder Twins in a disintegration pit, see the final fate of the Super Sons. If you feel bad about not caring for Denny's script for this issue, go pick up the current Green Arrow 80th Anniversary Special and the wonderful tribute story Tap, 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 written by Denny's son Larry O'Neill and drawn by Jorge Fornes, a beautiful tribute to one of comics' greatest creators. I miss Ramona's art, but I will never complain about getting to see more Schaff. I have to look this issue up on the DC app to check out his drowned Batman with even soggier ears than usual. Thank you, Chris. Paul Kien, of course, you just heard him in this episode, says, great episode as usual. Martin, great to hear you, as always. Most of the action is fine, but I had to agree with you, Rob, that the complete randomness of Merlin made no sense. It should have been an easy fix. Maybe they were filming a movie in England and they dug up Merlin by accident. With regard to Kurt Schaffenberger's art, I always felt that his art was a bit boring, but as I've gotten older, I can completely respect his storytelling ability and consistency. I prefer Ramona Fraiden on Super Friends, but Kurt can certainly keep them on model. True enough, Paul. Sean M. Myers, of course, another previous guest from the show, says, hello, Martin, and welcome to the podcast. You did a great job. I love the Super Friends comic so much, I can definitely enjoy lighthearted whimsy. I can also enjoy stories that don't really make a lot of sense. This issue is my least favorite Super Friends comic. It just doesn't come together to tell a great tale. I am very glad I came to the comments of this each episode, and especially so far for this issue. Regarding Celador, thank you for posting the info about Black Lightning, Black Vulcan, and for the link to the interview. It is much appreciated. regarding Chris. Thanks for the info about Danny O'Neill. It does add a bit of understanding to the situation, and LOL, but it doesn't make me like the story any bit more. Fair enough, Sean. So that is going to do it for the comments for issue 20 of For All Mankind. Again, thanks everybody for the comments over on the website, finewaterpodcast.com. I very much appreciate it. Big thanks to my pal, Paul Ken, for coming back and covering this issue with me. It is always fun to talk to Paul, and he will certainly be on future shows here on the network. So that's going to do it for this episode of For All Mankind. We're always talking super friends over on Twitter at For All Mankind SF. You can find all the back episodes of our show on our website, again, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Fallen Mankind on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you're going to lock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill, Stanford M. Brown, Gord Tolton, and David S. Gutierrez for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So that's going to do it. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode. We will look at Super Friends number 22, It's Never Too Late.
An FW TV podcast.